Hey gang, it's Academy Bites for you this week. Bites are occasional samplings from the private podcast feed, the ICA Pearls, which is available to the Intensive Care Academy members. The Academy is something you should check out if you haven't over at icu101.com. Tons of more learning over there, but it includes this particular feed as well as a million videos and other things. Check it out if you'd like. Otherwise, on to the show. Hey guys, it's Brandon. I wanted to reflect today on the idea of specialization and what it really means. Brian and I recently spoke on the live stream about, the general practice of dividing critical care up into different subspecialties and kind of the pros and cons of that and what that means. But I think it's interesting to reflect on what it means to be a specialist or a master of a certain knowledge domain. Probably some of us like to think that we are specialists, if not masters, of critical care. But what that really means about our knowledge base, I think, is not obvious. And here's the premise that I want to try to argue for. Specialization or mastery, in general, is actually not about an incredibly deep level of knowledge in any one particular area or topic or thing. It's actually more about breadth than depth. So in a sense, it's really more about generalization and your broad knowledge than your specialized knowledge. And you're gonna say, no. Like, I'm a specialist in something, and really even a subspecialist that knows a lot about just a few things knows something incredibly deep about those things, and that's what makes them specialists. That's true in a way, but let's dive into this. Let's say you're sitting in the ICU and you are super smart about critical care, and a nurse comes to you with a question. Patient did this. Do you want to do that, or what do you want to do? And let's say it boils down to, should you give the patient fluid? That's, one of the classic dilemmas in critical care. And this is a good example because it is one of the deeper and more complex questions. I mean, anyone would agree that more has gone into the topic of fluid responsiveness than practically any other topic in critical care. It's controversial. So if your deep level of wisdom is going to bear on anything, it should bear on this. But really, really, truly, if we're honest, when you think about this question and you decide what to do, it's a yes or no thing, how many considerations are going into it? Probably just a couple. Or one. You're thinking, well, on one hand, this patient is already very positive on their fluid balance. They're 10 liters up in the past 2 days. So that makes my pretest probability that they're going to be fluid responsive and benefit from more fluid kind of lower. On the other hand, the day shift who just signed out to me 2 hours ago said that they kind of thought, based on their day and maybe they did a ultrasound or a passive leg raise or something, they kind of had the gestalt, the sense that this patient could still be fluid responsive. Maybe it's no more than those two things that go into this. And you say, well, yeah, sure. But your kind of what you walk into that decision with, the stage that's been set, is based on all the stuff you already knew. The dozens of articles you read on this, debates you've observed, textbooks you've consumed, reflecting you've done on the topic of fluid responsiveness. Yeah, sure. But in the end, it all comes down to relatively simple decision-making. And again, this is one of the more complex ones. Think about many more simple ones. Should you resume this patient's home medication? It's tramadol. And you look at it and you think, well, pro is that they may have some pain and it will help with that. Con is that tramadol is a bad drug. And maybe that's as simple as your decision is. And yes, something fed into that because you've known in the past that it can promote serotonin syndrome and lower the seizure threshold and things like that. And perhaps you've heard people like toxicologists opine that they just really don't like the thing. But in the end, it's as simple as, I try not to start tramadol. So even decisions or knowledge areas that seem quite complex, if you kind of zoom in at the individual decision points, there's usually only a couple of data points or factors that weighed into it. And you could easily take someone who's not a specialist or an expert and teach them to make the decision you just made. For this situation, this patient, I'm going to do this or not going to do this because of XYZ. But really, it's often like X, maybe XY, a very small number of things. Now, of course, that particular decision may not apply to another situation that's a little different. And that's what we're getting into. It's not really about depth when you zoom into this micro level. It's about breadth. The next patient who comes along, those considerations may not apply, but a couple of different ones will apply. They're a slightly different person, and different factors bear upon your decision, and those things you need to know. And then the next patient comes along, and they're a whole different person, so there's a whole nother thing. That's actually what being an expert is. It's knowing all of those things, even though only a couple are relevant in this case. Does that make sense? But you can see how from the outside, it may seem as though each of those decisions was incredibly nuanced and sophisticated. But like, what would that even mean? It would mean like you have to analyze like 32 data points to make this one decision. But that almost never happens. Again, it's the number of decisions you're making that makes it difficult. But each one of them, in a way, was simple. So that, I think, really is what makes our job difficult. And so when you reflect on mastery, what that sort of means is generalizable knowledge and breadth of knowledge is kind of more what it's all about. Because you don't know which things are going to be important to your next decision. So you need to know all the things, even though you're maybe only going to use one or two. I mean, you make a lot of snap decisions based on one or two factors during your day, but a lot of them are different decisions. So what are some times where this is relevant? Well, how about training clinicians? If you're going to say, well, critical care or any specialty is extremely specialized and difficult, therefore it's hard to train people to do it, take a role like myself as a PA or, you know, APPs. The whole premise here, to some extent, is that you can train people in specialized areas more easily and in less time than training them with a great deal of generalized training, as the physicians usually do. They start much more general and broad, medical school and then a residency, and then they finally funnel down to basically the thing that I only do, which is critical care. I never went to, let's say, an internal medicine residency. And so if you're saying, well, is that okay? These people lack certain specialization. That's true, but know what it is that you're saying. In many cases, it's not the individual skills to do a thing or make a decision. It's more about breadth. I often feel like what really is the hallmark of a smart clinician is never a particular specialized moment. It's breadth. It's the intensivist who still remembers how to treat a rash. Part of that general skill set that doesn't come up that much, but to be able to pull that knowledge in when it's applicable makes you have it's a far more stable footing to the things you do. You know, you funnel in on any one thing, you can teach that to anyone. I can teach the nurse to make the decision I just made, or the IT guy, but then I'm going to have to teach a different decision for the next one and the next one and the next one. Think about AI. You know, we're really starting to see more and more AI decision makers and tools play a role in medicine, and that's probably only going to grow. But again, what is it that we do that is hard? It's probably never making any one decision. It's about breadth of things. And while I'm not an AI expert, I would have to imagine that that's something you can fairly easily train AI to do, because they're good at knowing a bunch of different things and remembering it, by the way, which is part of the challenge for us. You can train people to an incredibly general level, but they're going to forget a lot of it unless you have some way of reinforcing it, reminding it, and convincing them that it's still worth their remembering. And hopefully this also demonstrates how it's really generally achievable to train anyone to do a very limited, finite set of things. You know, you see, just to use my own role again, PAs, I see PAs in some surgical specialties where it seems like the whole job they were hired to do was like one or two basic sort of workflow tasks, like pre-ops or post-ops or something like that. And I'm not going to speak for that. I'm sure there are times and ways in which it's hard, but a lot of it seems fairly simple. But that also means that you can take, you know, like a new grad and probably train them to do that job in a fairly brief amount of time. And I don't think most people would argue that it's effective and safe, because it's so finite of an expanse of things. It's not that broad or general. It may be quite specialized. They may be doing some very specific specialized things that I could never do because I don't know how, but it's just a few. That's easier than training them to do 1,000 things, even if they're all, when you get down to it, fairly simple things. The great podcaster Mark Crislip from the Goblet of Pus ID podcast, a very long-careered ID clinician, he said a few times that what really is the hallmark of a specialist is mastery of the literature. Knowing the studies in your field and being able to call them to mind or to find them if you're not familiar with them. And well, I think on some level this is true just because you should know the data if you believe in science. But this also reinforces my point. For a particular decision, if you're invoking a reference, a study that was done, I mean, how many? There's probably like one. Or maybe a couple. I mean, maybe you make sure they agree or something. But it's not like there are, 62 RCTs that bear on this, unless it's one of those really hotbed topics. The specialist is the guy who looks at a decision anyone else is just making reflexively or thoughtlessly and says, yeah, I mean, there was just last year, there was a modest-sized trial on this in the journal of such and such that found this. And other people don't know that, but they know that. And that's not such a huge deal, but for the next decision and the next one, they also kind of know where the science is at in a degree of currency and comprehensiveness that other people don't have. And that presumably makes their thinking and decision-making that much more thoughtful. But any one of those things is not hard to know. You just know that one study, and someone else probably happens to know one of them because they came across it or they wrote a paper on it or something. But they don't know all of them. That's what makes the expert. That's what I think, you guys. You let me know if you disagree, but I think it's a sort of helpful orientation to reflect on, like, this is really what it means to be an expert. Because otherwise you can get kind of hand-wavy and be like, oh, the things I do are so subtle and nuanced and specialized that, you could never learn to do it without, all the training that went into this. But in 99% of the case, I don't think that's true. You can train someone to do any one particular thing often pretty easily. One decision, one piece of knowledge, one skill, procedure. It's the fact that there are just a lot of them that makes your work hard. And of course, sometimes you can't do one without doing others. They kind of all synergize and support each other. You let me know what you guys think. I'll talk to you next time.